This podcast is brought to you by Bodog.net.
Don't miss a chance to play at Bodog.net. When the odds are stacked against you, post-game tastes that much sweeter. Bodog.net, your source of free casino games, poker strategies, and live sports odds.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to In the Box here on TSN 1200. Graham Creech, Brad Fritch with you here today, and Kenny Walls as well. And it's time to go back to the Gabriel Pizza Hotline and welcome in our next guest, Travis Yost, who writes for TSN.ca, and we'll get into his latest on Connor McDavid in a moment. But because Brad Fritch is co-hosting today, Brad Fritch obviously has a connection with the Senators as well as the Carolina Hurricanes. And Travis, first off, welcome to the show, but time to tell Mr. Fritch that you have predicted Oilers-Canes final.
I am predicting Oilers-Canes final, and it was a very scientific approach of me picking the two teams that I thought would reach the Stanley Cup, and that was the end of the approach. But we are just five games out on each side from Carolina, Edmonton, and maybe we see Cam Ward horror show 2.0 for Edmonton.
Travis, so being down here in North Carolina, being a pseudo Canes fan, Sens fan first, but I also pay attention to the Hurricanes down here. What specifically impresses you the most about what the Hurricanes do?
I think Carolina's argument, or certainly their argument in the Eastern Conference, is that they have the deepest forward group in the league. It's certainly comparable to the likes of Colorado and Tampa Bay. They play so well throughout the lineup that it is very, very hard to beat Carolina, even if their top players are having an off night, because lines 1-4 and pairings 1-3 are generally playing most of the game in the offensive zone. It does not matter who they are throwing out on the ice. Brock Brindamore's team, they play with insane pace throughout the lineup, and it seems like they far more often than not dictate the terms of play irrespective of their opponent. And what it does is, you know, when you don't have the bona fide superstar, and clearly they have top-end talent, right? Andre Svechnikov, Aho, a bevy of defensemen that are really grade-A players in this league. They have plenty of talent, but in the absence of a true bona fide top-six, top-eight type superstar player, what you really need is performance throughout the lineup, and that's what you get with Carolina. And in some ways, they feel a lot like Colorado, maybe just without the Nathan MacKinnon factor. And if you were to ask, and quite frankly, most of the sports books priced it that way, some of the most realistic, or the, you know, at least from a betting standpoint, some of the more realistic Stanley Cup outcomes when the bracket was first drawn up was Carolina, Colorado. And you know, I think Carolina is still going to be in tough. The Rangers team is game, and I think we've seen. Don't ever count out Tampa Bay, irrespective of whatever health situations they have throughout their lineup, because they just win hockey games. But they're just five games away, Carolina. We might be seeing a repeat of it.
Yeah, Canes play at an incredible pace. The game one win where they came back, they were sleeping through two periods, and I thought just the way they played in the third was super fun to watch them. You mentioned Colorado, of course, place that on fast forward throughout the game. But with Carolina, they're 7-0 at home. They've yet to win on the road. Do you have an explanation for that?
I don't, other than some degree of randomness. I will say this, though. I mean, look at you got to, when you have such small samples like this, you've got to take in some of the context. And look at their round two road opponent, just as an example, right? I mean, there are a few tougher places to play on the road than Madison Square Garden in a playoff game. It's just one example, right? I mean, I put MSG in the playoffs, you know, maybe not on par with the Bell Center, but pretty close. It's not as if Carolina is having an easy trip on the road in this series right now. And quite frankly, like, you know, there's still a decent shot the Rangers to push us to seven games. So the other thing too, Carolina's biggest weakness, and it's not lost on me. I wrote about this earlier, but Carolina's biggest weakness, their team weakness, is they consistently carry a penalty imbalance. Consistently, they take way too many penalties and they don't draw nearly enough. Whether how much you put that on officiating versus the individual talent of the Carolina players and their ability to draw penalties or not, apportion that as you see fit. However, I will say this, knowing that they have a giant penalty problem, officiating teams tend to give out kinder whistles to teams at home than they do on the road. So that certainly, I think, plays to some degree of it anyway.
So switching over to the Western Conference, have you been surprised that, irrespective of the last couple of games against Calgary, that the Edmonton Oilers depth players have performed so well when that was kind of the missing link to everything that was keeping the Oilers from achieving their potential?
Yeah, to some degree. I think there have been three games over the first two rounds, which is not insignificant, by the way, that the Edmonton depth players, I say, would outright have either won the games or played a major role in winning these games. But, like, even you go back to the Los Angeles series and, like, just look at what it looked like with McDavid on the ice versus not. I think the Oilers outscored the Kings by 7 goals with McDavid on the ice, but were 3 goals underwater with any other line on the ice. So, I mean, even just in the first round matchup against probably one of the weakest teams, maybe the weakest team in the playoffs, I said a couple weeks ago, I mean, Edmonton could have lost that series. And it's easy to say, oh, Edmonton could have lost that series without McDavid. Well, yeah, take the best player out of most teams, and that's generally going to be the case. But I have to say, in the Calgary series, look at last night. I mean, yeah, McDavid was the cherry on top, as always. But, you know, some of that Edmonton comeback, that furious comeback that we saw after Calgary gets out to the early lead, that was their second and third line putting in, you know, yeoman's work. And I think taking a little bit or even a little bit of the workload and burden off McDavid. And I'll tell you what, like, you know, they're going to be, assuming Colorado wins a series, and that's a big assumption because St. Louis is the scrappiest team in the league. But if Colorado does win in advance, I think everyone agrees that Colorado is probably the most talented team in the league. If Edmonton is getting something out of their depth players, though, I picked Edmonton out of the West, and, you know, a lot of it was I just think McDavid was going to go supernova, and that's exactly what happened to, like, three orders of magnitude higher than I thought. But I will say this, if they are getting this degree of production from their second and third lines especially, and they can just get some decent goaltending, just average goaltending from Mike Smith, they can beat Colorado in a series. I think that would be an all-time fun series, number one. The only reason that gives me pause, as fun as this Oilers run has been, I think if you ask any Oilers fan, the amount of heartburn they've had watching Mike Smith over the last two rounds is not an insignificant level. So that remains a big question mark until it's not for everybody.
TSN.ca's Travis Yost is our guest, and just staying with the Oilers here, and McDavid specifically, Dreisaitl, of course, is lighting it up as well. 5 straight games in that series with at least 3 points per game. They are just lighting the playoff scoring race on fire, and McDavid, your latest is on McDavid and what he's actually doing right now. And I think coming into the playoffs, I think there was a portion of fans and media that were arguing that other players were the best in the world. I think that question has been answered, that McDavid's on a level all by himself right now. Can you put into perspective what he's doing?
I mean, I encourage people who haven't read it yet. I put something together on Wednesday night, but statistically speaking, and certainly over the last 15 years where our data has been, you know, impressively gapped up from what the NHL is tracking, we have never, ever seen a player on a scoring surge like McDavid is right now. Going into the series clinching game, the Oilers were scoring almost 8 goals for 60 minutes with McDavid on the ice and at even strength, and that is against playoff-caliber teams in Los Angeles and Calgary. And if you compare that to the best playoff performances we've ever seen, Sidney Crosby's had a handful of them, Pavel Datsyuk, Nathan MacKinnon in 2020, they're 30, 35, 40% off the pace that McDavid has set through the first two rounds. I look at the data and I'm beyond blown away because we don't have a statistical comparison for it. We don't, period, end discussion. I think the more interesting thing is when you watch these games, it is so patently obvious he's that much more talented than anyone else on the ice. And, you know, I was debating this with a few people, but it's like, you know, some people say, well, it kind of reminds me of Lemieux, and it kind of reminds me, the first person I thought of was peak Eric Lindros, right? Like, Eric Lindros in his prime, the way he completely dominated games. I think of that game 4 play where Nikita Zadorov tried to put this, you know, big check on McDavid, and he just got basically smacked away like a mosquito on top of just the ridiculous agility around the ice. I have to be honest. I don't, at least in the modern era of what we consider stats, which is 2007 onward, I don't ever remember a performance remotely close that includes the best of Sidney Crosby, that includes the best of Alex Ovechkin. He has put me at a loss for words more often than not this postseason, and I would guess I'm not alone in that group.
And then the Oilers have Mike Smith, which, I mean, hey, he battled his way through, you know, five games with Calgary. He outperformed Jacob Markstrom, which surprised the heck out of me. But I want to go to his puck handling and a data-driven question. Is there a way to quantify what that means to the Oilers breaking out of their zone in a way that you could relate it to if he wasn't as good handling the puck?
Yeah, I think this has been an interesting debate over the years because I think the way the discussion has been qualitatively framed is goaltender who plays puck helps defense transition, and that is a factual statement, right? That a goaltender playing the puck and moving the puck up ice can help with transitions and jumpstart the offense. On the other hand, we see not infrequently goaltenders who are, you know, considered great puck handlers make gaff after gaff moving the puck or not moving the puck or flubbing the puck. And, you know, Mike Smith's just the latest example, right? Who can forget the days of Marc-Andre Fleury, who's going to go in as, you know, first ballot Hall of Famer. So, you know, this has been a common discussion. And I think, you know, the work hasn't been done on it, so I don't think anyone can give a, you know, definitive referendum in the public space right now. But the way you would look at this is sequences in which a goaltender did touch the puck or did not touch the puck. Should he have went after the puck and transitioned it up ice? If so, did it lead to a shot attempt or a scoring chance in the next 10 to 15 seconds? Did it lead to a shot attempt or scoring chance against in the subsequent 10 or 15 seconds? And what you're truly trying to look for is, as a function of the goaltender moving the puck or making the decision not to move the puck, what was the byproduct of the on-ice result? That work hasn't been done yet. I will say, like, you know, I you see the merit of both sides, right? Like when a goaltender can transition, you know, and take some of the burden off a blue line, especially in the playoffs when they are getting hammered, there's tremendous value there. But the problem is the mistakes. If a goalie makes a puck handling mistake, again, especially in the playoffs, it tends to be a critical mistake. And I think one of the things that the league and the community needs to do a better job of is, including myself, is understanding what that risk reward is to make better decisions when it comes to goaltending puck handling.
Travis, since GM Pierre Dorion joined the station a couple days ago and said that the number 7 overall pick will potentially be in play and be moved, and he did reiterate once again that they are looking for help in the top 6 as well as a top four blue liner. What do you think, in your opinion, do you think the Senators should do this offseason?
Boy, they have a lot of work to do. I mean, that state the obvious. I do think the one thing that's interesting for Pierre Dorion, and we've heard this for, it feels like, 5, actually 10 years now, is we want a top 6 forward and we want a top 4 defenseman. Well, you know, that's factually true because they have, you know, holes clearly in both groups. Defensively, they have a numbers problem where they have so many players signed for next year, and I don't understand, you know, the Delzato contract, the Hamonic contract. It kind of hurts a little what they can do. On the forward side of it, you know, everyone's talked about Claude Giroux, and, you know, he just came out yesterday and how much he loves playing for Florida, and, you know, is he going to stay there? Kevin Fiala's been a very popular name. He's off an 85-point season. I think there's two options for Ottawa, especially if they want to put a pick or picks in play to improve this team. I think when it comes to the forwards, you've got to go after you've got to take a look at Andrew Mangiapane in Calgary, and I would not. If you look at Calgary's cap situation, they have a lot of money already tied up and a lot of expiring players: Kachuk, Gaudreau. Kelly Yarncroft comes off, Andrew Mangiapane's due, Oliver Shillington's due the next contract. There is a lot of expenditure coming their way this summer. There is going to be a cap crunch for Calgary, and therein lies a potential opportunity. I do wonder, you know, if Calgary makes a decision to commit money to Kachuk, to Shillington, to Gaudreau, as we expect, and maybe goes, you know, on the periphery and adds someone, it could be Mangiapane who's on his way, you know, who's kind of on the outside looking in. I think Calgary recognizes how valuable he is, but boy, would that be a blessing if Ottawa could make an enticing offer for him. Defensively, I look just right across the street in Toronto. I think another completely cap crunch team. I think there's an opportunity to dual offer sheet the Maple Leafs between Sandin and Timothy Liljegren, who are both due contracts for next year. You can stagger those offer sheets, do the first and the third comp for one, do the second comp for another. You could effectively put $10 or $11 million of offer sheets on the Maple Leafs on two really promising 23 and under defensemen, and really bring in potential top, you know, potential, if not likely, top four talent. Would it mean moving Delzato or a Zaitsev or any of these other number of players, you know, occupying roster space? Yes, but I think that's a net win, and the team needs more puck movers. I think it's a logical plan 1B if Pierre Dorion wants to go that route.
Great stuff. Travis, thanks for joining us. I know that your latest on McDavid is up at TSN.ca. Is there anything else you're working on that we can expect in the next day or two?
Yeah, well, you just kind of gave me a little bit of a summer project here with the goaltending puck touches and capture and quantify this. So thanks for the free work I'll be doing now. Other than that, now we're all good. Have a good weekend, guys.
Right on. Thanks. Have a great rest of your day.
Take care, guys.
There goes TSN.ca's Travis Yost, just spending some time talking Stanley Cup playoffs and a little bit of Sens there. We'll take a break, come back with more. Still to come today on the show in terms of guests. Tim Baines at 12:40 and then Gord Wilson at 1 o'clock as In the Box continues on TSN 1200.
This podcast is brought to you by Bodog.net.
Don't miss a chance to play at Bodog.net. When the odds are stacked against you, post-game tastes that much sweeter. Bodog.net, your source of free casino games, poker strategies, and live sports odds.
Welcome back to In the Box here on TSN 1200. I can pass along that both Felix Auger-Aliassime and Leyla Fernandez are off to the fourth round at the French Open with third round victories today. Felix in straight sets, Leyla in three sets, as they both around to the both advance to the fourth round. Tonight it's a game day here on TSN 1200 as the Red Blacks host the Toronto Argonauts. 6 o'clock pregame, 7:30 kickoff from TD Place. We will have both U.S. versus Finland and Canada versus the Czechs in the semifinals at the World Hockey Championships on Saturday, 7 a.m. U.S.-Finland, 11 a.m. Canada-Czech. We'll have the gold medal game Sunday at 1 o'clock, and we will have Game 7 of the NBA East Final, if it happens, Boston and Miami, as they are set to play Game 6 this evening. So if there's a Game 7, we will have that. I know that you and JR spent a lot of time, and we'll revisit this with Gord, on the Battle of Alberta and the should it have been a goal, should it not have been a goal, etc. And of course, you guys have spent some time earlier this morning on the Hurricanes and Rangers as well. But just wanted to touch on Blues Avalanche with you, Fritchie, here, as the Blues are set to host Colorado at 8 o'clock tonight. The Avs lead that series 3-2. Nate McKinnon, all world in game 5 with a hat trick. Watched that entire game start to finish. He probably could have had about 10 points. He was awesome. But it's the Blues who rally from 3-0 down and then a late 4-3 deficit to win it in overtime and keep their season alive. What's your feel on this series? Do you think Colorado finally gets over the second round hump?
Gosh, I don't know. I mean, to have that happen, up 3 goals, then up 4-3 late, and for St. Louis to come back, score the game tying goal late in the third period, and then the overtime goal, just devastating, I would think. Now they have, you know, 2 more games to, I guess, quote unquote, play with here, but you just want to get these things done as fast as you can, and that was a huge opportunity squandered, and frankly, like, you know, Husso hasn't been great, but Kemper hasn't been great either, and I thought he might be the difference once Binnington went down, and so he's probably got a little bit of self-doubt going. Can I get Can I do this? Can I get through it? Can I help my team win? So it's going to be interesting to see if Colorado can just put the hammer down, because I think they are clearly the better team. But you have to go and do it. And like Travis was saying earlier, Blues are such a battle-tested team. They know what it takes. They got, you know, consummate playoff warrior Ryan O'Reilly playing for them. And you know, they have the memories of the Stanley Cup victory just a couple years ago. So I think Colorado will get it done. I think they should. But one thing I think we've learned is never count out St. Louis Blues. They're just so playoff hardened. And it wouldn't surprise me at least to take it to game seven.
And they're super deep offensively as well. Maybe not as high end depth as the Avalanche possess, but they can roll three lines that they, I think they had 9 20 goal scorers in the regular season. When you got a guy like Kyrou on your third line, you have guys on each line that can get it done. They're a good team. I think heading into the postseason, I thought they were the second best team in the Western Conference. I know Edmonton certainly has something to say about that now, especially with how McDavid and Draisaitl are playing. But yeah, St. Louis, real solid team. I got to ask you, personally, I'm not a fan of Jordan Binnington in terms of the tough guy attitude he kind of pretends that he has at times, but what's your opinion on him? Like he gets under my skin. He's probably one of the players that I like the least in the league. What are your thoughts on Binnington?
He's colorful. That's for sure. I think he's kind of, to me, like Tony DeAngelo a little bit, and not to say, like, I don't have a ton of bad stuff to say about DeAngelo, the player, because he's had such a good impact for the Hurricanes this year. But like, there's some times where DeAngelo is just yapping for no good reason, right? The other night, I think the play was over, a couple seconds went by, and then he just took a shot at someone as he's skating by innocently. Like, just the, again, same thing, like the fake tough guy attitude, kind of in the same realm. But if that's what he needs to get going, I guess I'm okay with it.
Yeah,
like,
we've asked
athletes for years to be who they are, right? Maybe it's not fake. Maybe it's just who he is and what got him to the league and made him a Stanley Cup champion. So I get what you're saying, though. There are certain guys in the league that just kind of rub you the wrong way. There's no two ways about it. So colorful player and can be really, really good at times. So I do get what you're saying.
So your Carolina Hurricanes won last night, as they always do on home ice in the Stanley Cup playoffs. Do you have any reason to believe that they'll win on the road? Like, obviously they're capable, but what's your gut? Are you just assuming they're going to lose at MSG and going to have to try to win on home ice in game seven?
Yeah, I think that's going to play out. I think it's going to go to game seven and they'll ultimately win. But I keep coming back to, you know, the matchup at home ice or at home where Jordan Staal can get on the ice against the team's top line and basically neutralize them at even strength. And that's happened against Boston and it's happened against the Rangers so far. So somehow the Rangers are going to have to either get their depth players to score on the road or Zibanejad, Kreider and Panarin to finally kind of break through against the Staal line, because Jordan Staal, I mean, for a couple of years before this, I really questioned, you know, is he worth? I think he had a $6 million a year contract for 10 years when he came here, but he's certainly earning it the last couple of years with what he does on the defensive end, and he does chip in points from time to time as well. But certainly, he is the captain of the Hurricanes, the leader, and if you have that ability to shut down the team's top line, only depth can kind of break through, and I don't think the Rangers have that depth if they come to Raleigh for Game 7, but. First things first, they need to go back home to MSG and win that game.
What's your opinion, as you watch way more Carolina Hurricanes games than probably most people in this market, but on Sebastian Aho, fantastic player. We know the offer sheet history, but I think part of when his name gets brought up in the postseason is just being how he's not on that level where of some other superstar players that we're seeing. Of course, nobody's on McDavid's level, but in terms of leading their team in scoring and putting up a pile of points, what's your take on what you've seen in the postseason and in the regular season of Sebastian Aho?
Yeah, I think he definitely has more to give. I think he has to be more selfish at times. Just shoot, shoot, shoot. Now, he has hit, but I think, three posts in the last two games. So right now the bounces aren't going his way. But I do think that there's another level that he can achieve. So talented. They got him in the second round somehow back when he was drafted. But I do think he has more to give, more to achieve in other than being, you know, he's a solid point of game player for the last couple of years. The issue, I think, with Aho is he kind of needs Teravainen stapled to his line to get his best out of him. And that's great. But if Teravainen is not playing well, and he does go through stretches once in a while where he's fighting the puck, you know, you kind of got to get away from that a little bit, because I think he can be a dominant player. As Travis was saying, you know, he's not a top 6, 8, 10 player in the league. He's, you know, that next tier, but I think he has a capability of being that. So I would love to see him break out as a Hurricanes fan and kind of see a greater progression from him.
Last Carolina Hurricanes question for you in this segment. And I know, just, you mentioned Tony DeAngelo. There's another player that a lot of people dislike around the league in terms of fans and probably players as well. But there's no denying his offensive ability and the seasons that he's had and the postseason that he's had. Not just him, though. How would you break down your opinion of the Canes' blue line?
It's really solid, as Travis said earlier. I was a little bit skeptical when they brought in both Ian Cole and Brendan Smith. In the offseason, I thought, they're kind of the same player. Mm-hmm. But in terms of playoff hockey, they're a great third pairing. Last year, when the Hurricanes faced the Predators in the first round, Jake Bean couldn't get on the ice. I think he was playing 6-7 minutes a night. Brendan Moore just didn't trust him, and they ended up moving him in the offseason. They go with these two guys. I think they thought Ethan Bear would also contribute a little more than he has, but he had COVID this year and never was the same after that. But Cole and Smith in the playoffs as a third pair has been really, really good. I said earlier, I think it might have been a JR, that they scored the first two goals against Shesterkin in games 1 and 2. They were the only guys who scored on him in the first two games. So that was kind of a really nice surprise for the Hurricanes. But up front, I think it was AJ and I talking about it the other day. Jacob Slavin is so good, and yeah, I wish people could get to watch him more often than not. Never out of position. His stick work is phenomenal. You know, if he knows he's beat, he's a really good skater and can get back. He has a little bit longer stick than most defensemen, and he uses it almost perfectly every time. He's kind of reminds me of Mark Stone, but playing defense, because he just strips guys all the time. There's a couple plays last night behind the net where I think Kreider had a step on him, and he just hooks the stick underneath, like through the legs, picks the puck up, reverses it, and all of a sudden he's skating out of the zone with it. He's a great player. And then Brett Pesce, having a player like DeAngelo come in and be able to play on the first line, allowed Pesce to go to the second line defense, and he's a really good player too. So having those two shutdown guys on the top two pairings is just such a key. It kind of reminds me of what I hope the Sens can be. You know, when they had Shabbat and Zub on the top line, it's just such a benefit to have Zub on line two if you can find a guy to play with them. I really do think that's an asset when you have two guys that can play, 46 to 47 minutes a night. I think that's such a huge, huge advantage. And last night, I think Slavin played 27 minutes. So to have him on the ice for that long is just, I mean, Rangers aren't going to score when he's on the ice. It's just, it's an anomaly when that happens.
Yeah, beauty of the playoffs is, for a lot of people, you know that certain players are pretty good, but you really get a better appreciation for how good they can be when you're watching them over a 7-game series through multiple rounds, rather than just maybe twice a season or whatever it ends up being. Before I'm just going to ask you this now, because I don't want to forget, in the last hour and a half or so that we have, and we do have Tim Baines coming up in the next segment, and then Gord Wilson at one. Mike Weir is at the top of the Senior PGA Championship leaderboard, and Stephen Ames, Mike Weir is currently at 9 under par. Stephen Ames, T2 at 7 under. How closely do you follow that, and how, where's Mike Weir's game at right now?
I do follow it a little bit because I have a couple of friends that play on the Champions Tour. I always enjoy seeing them play well. So a good friend of mine from my web.com/Korn Ferry Tour Days. His name is Scott Perrell. And over the last 5 years, he's had really, really big success on the Champions Tour, but he never played on the PGA Tour. He won a web.com event very late in life at 48 years old, but was never able to get his PGA Tour card. But I knew if he got onto the Champions Tour, he would play really, really well and make a ton of money. And he has done that. So I thought when Mike Weir got onto the Champions Tour, I felt like he could do really well because the courses are a little bit shorter. I think one of the things Mike has always struggled with is trying to keep up with everyone off the tee. That infamous round with Tiger, I think it was in 1999 at the PGA Championship, where he either had the lead or was very close to the lead final group on the final day, and he blew up. And he always said that he was a little bit cognizant of the fact that he was getting outdriven by 40, 50 yards. And it's something I think that he always was in the back of his mind. He's such a good wedge player. He's such a good putter that he doesn't need length. I mean, it's always a benefit, but he can compete and he can win without it. Now that he's with players of his age, 50 and older, I think it's really given him a good perspective on, hey, you know, being long is nice, but playing your own game, wedging it close, making putts is the key to his own success. And he's certainly proven that on the Champions Tour. It's great to see because he went through a kind of a black hole for a while. He went through 6 or 7 instructors in 6 years and was just kind of a little bit lost. And I'm glad he's found his game, and I'm certain that he's a lot happier now than he was a couple of years ago, because it's not fun to grind and not see success. It's always so gratifying when it's the opposite, when you work hard and you're rewarded, and he is being rewarded right now. It's really good to see.
Awesome stuff. Obviously rooting for him for the through the weekend. All right, we'll take a break. Tim Bain's going to join us next to tee up Red Blacks Argos first game of the season. We weren't sure going into yesterday if we're gonna have today be a home game day for the Red Blacks, but we will, and Bainsey will tee it up next on In the Box and TSN 1200. Welcome back to In the Box here on TSN 1200. It is a game day as the Ottawa Red Blacks host the Toronto Argonauts at TD Place at 7:30. It's a 7:30 kickoff. AJ and Jeff with the call. Lever Sage is your pregame beginning at 6 o'clock. And we go to the Gabriel Pizza Hotline and bring in to the show from Post Media, Tim Baines, to tee up the first game of the season here. Tim, good afternoon. How are you?
Well, I'm pumped. Even with the rain, I mean, it's good to not be talking about ratios and ratification bonuses and collective bargaining agreements. It's game on. Let's bring it on.
Yeah, what was your confidence level throughout the week? Like, did you think that today was going to happen?
Well, it's been a roller coaster ride, I'm sure, not only for myself and the fans, for the players, because this really has been, I'm sure, agonizing for a lot of them. It's not like a lot of these guys are bringing home, well, I mean, I don't want to minimize the importance of making $65,000 a year, but it's not like they're making huge money. And really, this is their livelihood. So I'm sure a lot of them are on edge. And it came right down to the wire. It came down to last night, a vote, and thankfully the vote was yes. And we at least have some labor stability.
So, Tim, obviously the CFL exists on a different plane than, let's say, NHL, MLB. Like you said, they're fighting for, you know, their paycheck to kind of make a living. Have you ever seen in the CFL kind of a discord between players on in that sense? Because there can be a pretty wide pay gap between players in the CFL.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, I think maybe behind the scenes they're grumbling a little bit when your starting quarterback can make $500,000 and you're on the practice roster making less than $1,000 a week. You know, it probably, there probably are grumblings behind the scenes, but I think football is a team game. It's about unity. So I don't think that there's that open kind of an issue, but yeah, there certainly is a wide variance in salaries.
Just looking ahead to not specifically just tonight, but the regular season. I think a lot of fans, the feeling at the station in terms of text messages, tweets, listener feedback is that people are excited for the season because, well, you count the season that was missed entirely, but the two seasons that were played surrounding that was some hard football to watch from a red-black perspective. And now there's been a lot of changes to the offense specifically, where I think a lot of people are optimistic, but looking forward to rooting for a team that doesn't win just a couple of games. What are your expectations for this group this year?
Yeah, I mean, let's be frank about it. The team has been stinky for a couple of years. Three wins in each of 19 and 21. I think for the fan base, it was disheartening, especially when you go to a home game and your team is down by 17 points at halftime. I mean, people are leaving the game at halftime. It's just disheartening when your offense, if you're going to lose, I think you want to lose 34-31. You want to leave your fans thinking right down to the final play that you've got a chance. But that hasn't been the case in a couple seasons. So I think there's a renewed enthusiasm. I think there are a lot of moves made in the offseason that give people optimism, starting with the quarterback, Jeremiah Masoli.
That was who I was going to ask about, Tim. I recall him playing for the University of Oregon so many years ago. Do you think he's the guy to kind of bring, I don't know about long-term stability because I don't know what his contract looks like, but do you think he's the guy to kind of take the Red Blacks out of their QB conundrum for the next couple of years?
Well, I think he certainly could be, and people would point to Dominique Davis was their starting quarterback, I think, back in 19. Didn't really produce what management thought he would. Last year, Matt Nichols, who was coming off shoulder surgery, I think still had some arm issues. And people could see that, and it's just frustrating, probably not only for the organization but for the fan base. And I think that a guy like Masoli, certainly not a long term answer, but it's not that long ago that he was the East nominee for the league's most outstanding player. So the guy, certainly when he's on top of his game, there are strong leadership qualities there, and certainly it's going to be a step up. But the quarterback's not going to do it on its own. I mean, the problems last year started with an offensive line that was really decimated even before training camp with the loss of Alex Mateus, their center, his backup, Alex Fontana, and then it was like a turnstile of rookies coming in and out. And if you've got four or five guys in your offensive line that haven't played at that level before, it was going to be trouble from day one. So when your offensive line breaks down, they had a suspect group of receivers. That doesn't bode well for the quarterback. So I think there's optimism all around. I think the offense, which is really what they needed to build, at least on paper, there's veteran presence there. There's a been there, done that presence there.
What are your expectations for the O-line? Because I do think that it was hard to evaluate the offense, even though I think, like you pointed out, it wasn't all there. I think that the team and fans were hoping for upgrades at certain skill positions, but how could you fairly judge what the offense was with the situation that the O-line was in? So with that said, what are your expectations for the O-line heading into this year?
Yeah, it really was hard to judge. And again, they've got four or five guys who've been around the league for a couple of years. It starts at left tackle. You have Cambry Williams, who's had some injury problems on and off, but has been an all-star in the league. Playing center, they're going to bump him out to left tackle, where he has some experience as well. If Jacob Ruby, Hunter Stewart, Darius Sirocco, Randy Richards. It really, it's just a different group, and it's not a group of guys fresh out of Canadian college football. These are guys that have been around a couple of years, and I think, especially in the offensive line, experience is such a key.
And the team, of course, made some moves at the receiver and running back positions as well. What are your expectations for the skill, aside from Jeremiah Masoli, the skill positions of the offense?
Yeah, we'll see what running back William Powell still has left. Fans, he was a terrific running back when he was in Ottawa, moved over to Saskatchewan. He's back, a little older. He hasn't actually practiced yet and will not play tonight, but they expect him to be back on the field soon. At receiver, just experience. Jalen Acklin, a younger guy, I think, who's still on the upswing, will be a key receiver for him. A guy like Darvin Adams coming off back-to-back Grey Cups in Winnipeg, huge. Tavon Smith, the Canadian receiver. A guy like B.J. Cunningham. There's just, again, a lot of experience. And the thing that comes with that, when you have so many guys coming into camp, there's a competition as well. And I think competition is good. I mean, guys can't have a bad day of camp. They can't have a bad preseason game, because if they don't perform, there's another guy there to replace them. And I'm not sure that was a factor last year. I think guys were starting because out of necessity, and there was no other guy. There was no backup plan.
So, Tim, have you heard anything from Coach Paul LaPolice about any philosophy changes on the offensive end, or do you think he's just leaning on that upgraded roster and more experience for the offense to flourish this year?
I think he's just looking for the offense to take a step ahead. He was the first-year head coach / offensive coordinator last year. It takes a while to instill to get a system in place. Of course, last year was because of COVID, of course, was training camp was delayed. There were no preseason games, which put them behind the eight ball, shortened season. So this year they're going to have really almost a full training camp. They're going to have two preseason games. I would think the changes he would make probably would be to suit his quarterback. I mean, you've got to have an offense that suits your quarterback's game. So I think they've made some changes, maybe taken even elements of the Hamilton Tiger Cat system that Jeremiah Masoli at times has been so successful in.
I think we've spent a lot of time focusing on the struggles of the team the last couple of years, but one of their strengths and one of the positives in each of those years has been defense and special teams. What are your expectations on that side of the football this year?
Yeah, more of the same from special teams. Of course, the Devontae Dedmon not with the team right now in an NFL camp. So certainly they take a big hit there, the best returner in the CFL, and we hope that it works out for him in the NFL, but I mean, if that doesn't, that's a fallback. He'll be back. They're going to look at a couple of guys, Ryan Davis, maybe Terry Williams back at return. It's just Bob Dice's units are always so good. Their special teams are always good. Defense, if anything, maybe a little bit better. Again, they added some depth there. Guys like Patrick Levels and Muddy Hunter, unfortunately. Defensive lineman Kwaku Boateng, they added a big Achilles rupture this week at practice. So that's a big loss. But I think across the board, again, offense is definitely better. I think the defense is ready to take a step up. And Bob Dice units, always good on special teams.
Last one for you. It's a game day at TD Place. How excited are you to be at the stadium?
Yeah, I'm just excited to be thinking that there's football, because the alternative for me, I mean, I don't know what sport the paper could get me to cover. I'm sure there are things, but I just don't want to think about the alternatives. I'm pumped. I'm excited to go to the football field every day, and I'm happy for the fan base, because we just want, I think the fan base just wants to see the Red Blacks maybe get back to the period where they were appearing in three Grey Cups in 4 years, not so much the three win seasons.
Absolutely. And it all kicks off tonight with their first exhibition game against the Argos. Tim, I really appreciate the time. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
There goes Tim Baines of Post Media teeing up the Red Blacks preseason opener as they host the Argonauts tonight at 7:30 at TD Place. Leverage gets you set at 6 right here on TSN 1200.